Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, and this is March the 6th. This is June the 6th, 1985. It is 8 o'clock. We're in Hearing Room B. We're having a work session on House Bill 2702 relating to wildlife law enforcement. We're having a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2202 relating to public utilities and House Bill 3021 relating to outdoor mass gatherings and House Bill 2838. Committee Assistant Maria Mesa.
Can I get followed?
No, we're going to do 2202 first.
Go ahead.
Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee will come to order. We have several things on our agenda today, including a motion to reconsider House Bill 2838, which we will get to when we have a quorum. In the meantime, we want to open a public hearing on House Bill 2202. Call Representative Anderson. I don't know where he went to, but let's be near the end of the session. Yeah, you can tell when it's getting near the end of the session. Hi, Andy, you want to come up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2202 comes to you from the House Energy and Environment Committee relating to public utilities. Representative Troop, as you know, Chair of Revenue next door, will be available if there are any serious questions. Representative Troop and I worked with a working group extensively, many, many hours, putting together a very delicate, I might say, bill that passed the House handily. Attorney Troop and I served at least three sessions on the Energy Environment Committee, along with many other people, but we were the two people on the committee who were there in 1981 when we came up with the original law. The original intent of the law was that we would allow, mostly we had in mind at that time, small head hydro, that we would allow 20 customers to be served by that facility. It was definitely in our mind that that meant 20 residential customers. Since that time, it was discovered by a utility that they could serve industrial customers under the terms of that law. And that did happen in regard to some biogas that came from the landfill to serve a industrial customer, hence the bill to clarify the intent, really, of the legislation. The loophole was there. We have redrafted the bill to grandfather what has gone on before, to allow one industrial customer. It exempts some of the processes that we feel need to have a boost in regard to solar and wind. Exempts some of the biogas, waste heat, and geothermal that are used for non-electrical purposes. For example, the geothermal that's used in Klamath Falls, of course, could be used for heating the downtown areas, which they are doing or contemplating doing, as long as they don't use that to turn it into steam to turn electrical generators. the waste heat provision is there would be an example, would be a large laundry who had excess heat could send that to a building or a concern next door. It's that type of exemption. You know, we've made it very clear that this legislation would provide for third-party financing. For example, a wood product plant would want to use some type of fuel to generate steam and to develop electricity for use on that plant site. Third-party financing means a bank could come in and finance and actually have ownership in that particular type of facility. If they did sell their excess power, that excess power from hog fuel plant or wherever it might be, would then be sold into generally an investor-owned utility. When in the working group, we had the Oregon Department of Energy, the Public Utilities Commission, the investor-owned electrical utilities, Northwest Natural Gas, a representative from the forest products industry. All of these people, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, have signed off on this particular legislation. We think it's vital, actually, to prevent, if you might call it, pirating of industrial customers of another utility. The House Committee recommends give the stamp of approval with a due pass recommendation, and I'd be glad to answer any questions if I'm able
Chairman?
To.
Senator Day.
Have you seen the amendments that have been proposed?
Yes, I have.
Are you in agreement with them?
No, I think they're a little bit onerous. That if I've seen the amendments that a small business might be identified as up to 200 employees, multiply that times 20, you've got up to 400 employees. Excuse me that, Mr. Chair, in all due respect, that would be a considerable, we use the word pirating, degrees. We've allowed for a little pirating, but not a lot of pirating, I guess, or taking away industrial customers from another utility.
Was there opposition, pardon me, Mr. Chairman, was there opposition in the House on this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, no. At the time we finished with the working group, there was no opposition came forward. All the working group was there and testified at the last work session. Public Utilities Commission, Department of Energy, the investor-owned, and Northwest Natural Gas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson, I guess what I want to get a feel for is what the perceived problem is, or if there's a real problem. The perceived problem, anyway, is that people involved in cogeneration or development of other resources might start basically, call it pirating, if you will, particularly industrial customers from an existing utility. Is that basically the concern that this bill attempts to address?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is the basic concern. Actually, if you would like to have the big example out there,
I
would be the Mist natural gas plant where you have a well, and in theory, that well, each well under subsidiary or whatever could serve 20 large industrial customers without regulation by the Public Utilities Commission. In other words, they could charge whatever they wanted to. It'd be somewhat unfair competition with the other investor-owned utilities who had been serving those particular customers, and that fear is there. So we've allowed one plus 19 residences, this type of thing, and some other alternate energy sources. We've done all that we could to leave the exemptions there from regulation in regard to solar, wind, and partial exemption under landfills,
right,
biogas, and some of those other things.
I guess I mean, the natural gas example is an interesting one because clearly to serve from the mist well, to serve 20 industrial customers would require a very extensive piping system. True?
True.
I suppose that is a concern, but I guess I kind of wonder about how realistic that really is for someone who's got a well to set up a piping system to serve 20 industrial customers. But I guess I'd have to say my only concern here is not with the natural gas. I mean, that's not, it's with the incentives that we provide for cogeneration. It seems to me that it's very important in terms of our overall energy policy to be encouraging every way possible cogeneration by industrial customers. What's your view of how this bill affects cogeneration?
Mr. Chair, my view of how it affects it is that certainly a large industrial plant under cogeneration, whatever type of fuel they use, to be able to use all that fuel in their plant. The limitation is that the excess fuel would go unregulated, as you might say, or regulated, depending on the circumstances, to an investor-owned utility, or it could be bought by a public utility. However, the advantage that they have, of course, as you know, is with Bonneville Power, generally have all they want. So mostly the customer would be the investor-owned utility.
And they are required by the Public Utility Commissioner to pay avoided cost, right, whatever that's determined by the Public Utility Commissioner to be.
That's correct.
Okay. Any further questions for Representative Anderson? Appreciate you taking the time to come over here.
Thank you. And Representative Troop will be available if you have any further questions.
Fine, thank you. Senator Hanlon, and I don't know who's with you, but please come up and introduce him.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Senator Hanlon, District 1. With me is Mr. Ed Stipkala, who's Vice President and Manager of CPEX Pacific Incorporated. There was a recent change of ownership and change of name there. Formerly, that's known as Reichold, and they've been in Columbia County for something like 20 years. They use vast amounts of natural gas from the nearby mist wells and expect to continue doing that. They are not, by their own definition, a public utility. And I think Mr. Stipkala will tell you that that's not their intention to become one. His concern is that in making these changes, they do not inadvertently be classified as a public utility. So with that, I would ask Mr. Stipkala to introduce himself and tell you his concern and respond to your questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome. Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, good morning. My name is Edward J. Stipkala. Vice President Manager at CPEX Pacific St. Helens plant, which is a nitrogen operations. Business address is 63149 Columbia River Highway, Post Office Box 810, St. Helens, Oregon. Senator Hanlon has covered the main points, and I have given you a handout which stresses our concern, and that basically being that we don't want to inadvertently see some legislation close off an option which may be necessary to us in the future. We do not own a pipeline right now, but we do use lots of natural gas. With the changing scene on the natural gas situation in the United States, it has been major changes since deregulation. And our company does own natural gas fields, CPEX Pacific, that is, in Montana. It's possible, through transportation arrangements, we're hoping to be able to get that gas to our operation here in St. Helens. We currently use transportation facilities in Northwest Pipeline and Northwest Natural Gas to buy gas, to get gas from Canada right now.
Hmm.
So, as we foresee, we'll probably continue to be transportation customers or maybe even sales customers of either or both of those utilities that I just mentioned. However, it is also possible, and in the future it may be economically feasible and viable for us to install our own pipeline, say from Northwest Pipeline Deer Island Gate to our plant, which is a distance of about 6 miles. And we don't have any plans on that at the moment, but we would hate to see that option precluded by any legislation. I think that is my concern. I'm glad to answer your question.
Senator Day.
How do you think House Bill 2202 impedes that?
We were concerned with part of the language that defined only on the residential customers as being anybody serving 20 residential customers. I just found out this morning from Commissioner Jim Marlin that apparently Section 3 on page 2 of the item there does allow people to service and allow a corporation to service their own needs, whether it be heat, light, or power, and not be classified as a public utility. At the time I wrote my testimony, I did not have that interpretation. So I did want to make certain that my concern was expressed. And
can you, could you, what, there is no Section 3 in the bill.
I beg your pardon, on page 2, line.
Sub 3, okay.
Sub 3, starting at line 11 on page 2.
Well, okay, let me, if I could pursue this a little bit, I want to make sure I understand. You are a utility customer.
That is correct.
Okay. So, now, if you were building a pipeline, you would build it. Is that correct also?
That
or would you have
correct.
Somebody else build it? I mean pay for it.
Yes.
Would you be the owner of it?
Yes, we would be.
All right, then I don't see how subsection 3 takes care of what you're concerned about. But maybe someone can explain that to me. Because that allows for third-party financing of acquisition or development by a utility customer. In other words, if you had somebody else developing it for you, that would be okay, but I don't see how it, but maybe someone can explain to us how it takes care of you.
I believe the commissioner will address that point.
He's signed up. We'll certainly hear from him. I want to make sure I understand your concern, because I certainly think it's a valid one here. What your concern is that you presently are served by by the drilling company or whatever.
Well, we're serviced by Northwest Natural Gas.
Are you purchasing your gas through Northwest Natural Gas, or are you just paying them for transportation?
The latter, only paying for transportation.
Okay. So you actually have a contract with the wellhead or whoever runs the wellhead,
correct.
And then Southern Pacific or Northwest Natural Gas is providing the pipeline. Now, do you know how you... I'm just trying to figure out where you come under this bill. I guess we'll get the public utility. Why don't we, Gene Maudlin, can you come up?
Thank you.
Yeah, why don't you stay there, and we'll just try to get this figured out right now.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm Gene Maudlin,
Welcome.
Public Utility Commissioner. there is nothing in present law or in these amendments or any other bill that I'm aware of that prohibits a person or a corporation from serving its own load under any manner it sees fit. So the amendment referred to on third-party financing simply means that if somebody else finances a project for you to serve your own load, that isn't covered either.
Okay.
So existing law covers a person who wants to do all of it himself. This makes sure that a third party could finance it for you. So this company is clearly exempt under the conditions that he described.
Okay. Because they can do whatever they need to do to supply their own needs, and nobody gets involved.
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, that's what we wanted to get on the record.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, Gene, did you have anything else to add to the bill? Why don't you go ahead and give it, you're on the list here, why don't you go ahead and give us some testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Anderson has given you a clear explanation of the need for the bill. I might add to his example two others. It is possible today to get power from BC Hydro, the state-owned corporation in Canada, down into this territory by a series of means, mostly using Bonneville power lines. BC Hydro is anxious to sell that its surplus power. It could do so to someone down here who could then use some of it for his or her own purposes and sell the rest to an adjoining industrial utility under present law. We would not like to see that happen. The second example is...
Now, tell me why you would not like to see that happen. I mean, it seems to me the benefits... you can tell me the downside. It seems to me the benefits are that we get lower-cost power available to industrial customers, which would help in their ability to continue to survive.
And higher cost power to all the remaining customers who continue to pay the embedded costs of the existing utilities.
Okay.
It's a balancing act, and we're in pretty fair balance today. There's deep competition for customers today among oil dealers, gas companies, electric companies. There's plenty of competition that is tending to drive those prices down, or at least have them remain stable. So I don't think we need that much more, especially when it would mean that there would be losers in Oregon and winners in Canada. The second...
Let me pursue this a little bit. I mean, what you're saying to me is that there's competition, which presumably either keeps prices stable or drops them. Doesn't that have the effect of shifting the cost of the embedded cost onto other customers? I mean, if there are embedded costs that have to be paid by all the ratepayers, and the competition is forcing the industrial rates, either keeping them steady or lowering them, doesn't that then, over the long haul, shift the cost of those embedded costs to the other customers?
I'm not sure I am.
Well, we don't have any competition in we do have some competition in the residential area between natural gas and electricity, for sure. But... what you're saying is we can't lower the cost to the industrial customer, right?
Oh,
because that means that somebody else has to pick up the embedded cost.
All right.
Okay. Now, I can understand that. But then you proceeded to testify that there was lots of competition.
Oh, I see.
And that is keeping industrial costs steady or lowering them, while presumably the costs are going up someplace else. So what I'm just kind of curious about whether aren't we,
no,
in effect, shifting the embedded cost?
I understand, Mr. Chairman. No, if the utilities or the oil companies want to lower the rates to industrial customers that have alternative sources, for instance, you can switch from oil or to gas. If a utility or an oil company wants to reduce its rate to that customer, I assure, in the case of the utility side, that other customers are not disadvantaged. I could not assure that if an industrial customer being served by Joe Schmidlap.
Okay.
Second example, Mr. Chairman, is that there is spot gas available, for instance, in Colorado, that could be transported by Northwest Pipeline to the Portland area. A industrial customer near that pipeline could tap into that pipeline, serve its own load, plus other nearby industrial customers, thereby doing the same thing as I described before. And we're just trying to avoid some of the disruption that might be caused by that kind of thing. As Representative Anderson said, 4 years ago when this language on 20 customers was passed, we all understood it to mean 20 residential customers, and it was for the purpose of encouraging such things as geothermal resources.
Questions for Mr. Maudlin?
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much. Denise McPhail, Portland General Electric.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Denise McPhail representing Portland General Electric, handing out some testimony. Most of which you've already heard about the original intent and our attempts to restore that. The area that has been, I think, of most concern to most people was without the subsection 3 of section 1 and subsection 5 of Section 2, which goes to third-party financing. The people who came to us were Boise Cascade. Now, they are looking at, they're not a co-generators yet. They want to co-generate. And so they did not want, if they didn't want to own their own unit, they didn't want a bank or an insurance company or whoever might finance this thing or operate it to come under the provisions of the PUC. And it was never the intent, I don't believe, of anyone to stop cogeneration under state and federal law. Anyone can serve their own load, whether you're an industrial customer or not. And as Representative Brad or Senator Bradbury has pointed out, cogeneration is an important resource, particularly for the future. And we don't want to stymie that. But at the same time, we're concerned, as are other, the PUC and others, that our residential customers aren't left with the blue milk at the end of the bottle when the cream is gone and picking up all those fixed costs by themselves. This slows down that industrial load going away. It doesn't stop it. And we recognize within our company, I think all of the investor-owned utilities recognize, that to keep that industrial load, we're going to have to be competitive. And we will be competitive. We've got no choice. We just don't want it to go away 19 at a time. So I would like to read into the record a statement of intent of what subsection 3 and subsection 5 mean. And people who agreed on this intent are PGE, PPL, Northwest Natural Gas, the PUC, and Boise Cascade. The sole purpose of subsection 3 of section 1 and of subsection 5 of section 2 of HB 2202 is to allow a utility customer to acquire or develop through whatever financing arrangements the customer selects energy resources to meet the heat, light, or power requirements of such customer at a single location without such customer or financier, including any investor-owned utility, being subject to the jurisdiction of the Oregon Public Utility Commissioner over rates or territorial allocation. If there are any questions, we strongly urge your support of this bill. Unamended, we do want competition to go forward, and we have to want it because it's going to go forward anyway. This bill does allow wind and solar new opportunities to go forward. Before they were restricted to 20 customers, now they can go to anyone, and both under the sales and territorial allocation, which I understand from the people who passed this bill originally, it only allowed for deregulation of price. So this is a further boon to them. And we really would like this committee to support it. We would hope you would pass it out unamended so we can get it through this session of the legislature. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Questions? I wanted to explore with you a little bit the provisions that relate to biogas, waste heat, or geothermal resources. If you could explain how the bill deals with them.
Okay. That provision is all because of concerns raised on the House side. Biogas, and I've got even got a definition that three agencies agree on. Biogas is that gas produced from decomposing solids, such as from landfills, from the sludge in sewage plants, and so that kind of gas. It's not pure methane. Apparently methane is about 60% of it, but it's a mixture kind of thing, and that for direct application, not to be used to generate electricity. The community administrator raised a concern about waste heat. The problem she raised is, what if you've got a big laundry, and Representative Anderson has told you about that. Does this mean, without this exemption, that they couldn't sell that waste heat to the company next door or companies next door, or if they were in a big facility, a big building, that they couldn't sell it and heat that building under this exemption? Yes, they could.
Yeah.
Geothermal is, and there were committee members that had concerns about letting geothermal go forward because they didn't want to set an incentive for generating electricity because they'd had experience with setting incentives for other power production. And so geothermal has its own statutes. There's geothermal heating districts, and this essentially keeps geothermal where it is now. It can be used in any city or any, you can form districts for geothermal heating districts. It just would not have the additional incentive for geothermal to generate electricity.
Basically, as I understand it, as long as it was a heat district like they're proposing in Klamath Falls, yeah, where you're distributing geothermal heat rather mm-hmm. than turning it into electricity and mm-hmm. distributing it.
Yes. Yeah.
You're
we originally had the language for direct application. People said, what did that mean? So we explored what that meant, and that meant non-electrical generation.
Right.
That's the only limitation on them.
Are there any further questions for Ms. McPhail? Thank you.
Thank you.
Alan Willis, Boise Cascade Corporation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name's Alan Willis. I'm with Boise Cascade Corporation. I wanted to concur in Denise's statement of what she calls legislative intent, that in fact that we want to maintain as much flexibility as we possibly can in the financing of any cogeneration project that we might want to pursue. The reason, of course, that we would rather do this off the balance sheet in many cases is to allow us to accumulate our capital and spend that capital on projects more directly associated with our primary businesses, which are making solid wood products and paper in this state. I might say, however, that our first preference is probably to have no bill whatsoever, simply because we think it ought to be the continuing policy of the state of Oregon to, wherever possible, encourage cogeneration of electricity, because in the long term what you're going to do with that policy is to forestall or at least delay the construction of large thermal facilities for the production of that electricity, something that this state apparently does not want to encourage at this point in time. So while our first preference is in fact that there be no
You got anything else to work on?
No, this is the last thing on our agenda. Is 3021?
Yeah. What do we have in here that we've got other things to? What other things do we have to work on of some consequence?
Oh, let's see. We got 2202.
A land use bill.
There's a partitioning relating to lots and partitions. It's a land use bill. It's Washington County is particularly concerned about.
Okay.
And then we have a bill relating to the Willamette River and dredging channel.
Recreational.
Which we are going to have a hearing on those bills on Tuesday. So we'll stand at ease for a moment until President Fulbush comes back.
I just got it.
Cheerio.
Bill we just heard what Toronto Metro was asking him to be further in Muckrake Waters.
Whether or not that could be unduly discriminatory.
Yeah, if you want to try to give people breathing room,
I've
got a couple of changes I'm going to suggest as a result of his conversation. We still disagree on that.
I'm like, wait on it. I'm really not
going to. Okay. I'd assume wait if we could.
Okay.
I'm not.
That one's okay.
We'll be up Tuesday. The Senate Energy.
Jason, we're going to be done.
Couldn't.
Oh, sure.
If Dave has a concern with it, I don't have, you can take it out.
Oh, my committees are done.
We're not.
Two.
We're almost done. I think Tuesday's hopefully our last day.
Do you have a concern?
Senate Energy Natural Resources Committee will come back to order.
He's ready to answer this question. ACLU may have some concerns about this here.
Representative Fallbush.
Okay, thank you.
Hi.
Good morning.
You want to go ahead?
Yeah. I'll try to. Where's everybody at?
Well, we've got three of us. You're doing really well. Senator Monroe is around here somewhere. Could you check for him in the hall? And I know Senator Brenneman was right there, too.
Okay, basically, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Wayne Fawbush. House Bill 3021 does a couple of things. And let me just briefly run through what we're trying to do in this piece of legislation. This is a result of some of the occurrences that have happened in Wasco County, and as a result of those occurrences, several shortcomings in existing laws relating to large gatherings and today's exemptions to a requirement to meet land use conditions is the reason for this bill. Now, when you have a situation that develops where shortcomings in the law have been pointed out, even if it's done by a single group, we as legislators have an obligation to take a look at that, see if indeed there needs to be some correction. 3021 is a suggested correction that will bring the mass gathering statutes into compliance with Oregon's land use laws, because the statutes on mass gatherings were created before our land use process began in this state. We think it's a reasonable approach, and I'd just like to take you quickly through it.
Good.
What it basically does is divides gatherings into two sections, short-term gatherings, and that's as defined in the outdoor mass gatherings on the first page, where it would be 2,000 people, but less if you have more than 2,000 people per day for longer than 120 hours, with that 5 days, then that would be, at that point, you'd be considered a land use issue, and to continue that large of a gathering for that period of time, you would be required to have approval of the local planning process for either a conditional use or a permanent land use change on that land. That's basically what the bill does. There are some other things in here, and why don't I just go through it quickly with you. The definitions are pretty much self-explanatory. On line 9, when we talk about less than 120 hours within any three-month period, that language is necessary because if you had somebody who was pretty sharp, they could have a series of five-day mass gatherings, one after another. And this is designed to say, no, we probably don't think that's wise for you to circumvent the intent of the law that way. So we've put that caveat in there to take care of that. Let's see. Section 2 sets the conditions, or Section 3 basically shall set the conditions. Section 4 deals with the health and safety issues for a gathering. Now, there's a typo, I believe, on line 9 of page 2, where it just would read better if you put a "the" between "to" and "anticipated" near the end of that sentence, according to the anticipated crowd, rather than according to anticipated crowd. That doesn't read well. The following list are what an applicant would need to provide to the local county governing body in order to realize a permit for a gathering. And it's important to point out in here that the governing body shall issue that permit. It is not a may or may not. They shall issue that permit when the festival is designed to go 5 days or less, if the permittee meets the conditions that are laid out here. Now, toward the bottom of page 2, under sub 6, where we detail the different requirements that need to be met, you will hear from Dave Fidanke, the ACLU representative, that those are too vague and could be unfairly discriminatory on the right of free assembly. The difficulty with that is that you have to have some flexibility in order to meet differing conditions within each county and within each mass gathering that would be applied for. It seems to me that there is a fair and reasonable check on that has worked very well in Wasco County. And that's the alternative to the court if you feel that you are being aggrieved or unduly discriminated against, because you have an automatic appeal to the court if you feel that the county governing body is setting up too onerous of standards. So we feel that you have a check there already. You will hear that check is not enough and that you should preclude any possible court action by being more specific, although they don't have language that would improve upon what I think this does. One question, I'll flag that for you, on 3, on lines 4, 5, and 6, That's boilerplate language to allow flexibility to meet differing conditions within a county. If you feel that the language is, that you need to tighten that up enough, you might consider eliminating lines 5 and 6, but it would be a judgment call that I think would tend to limit each county's ability to deal with specific instances relating to their conditions and the individual applicant. But I think that's a judgment call that you will have to make as a committee.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Day.
Are you finished on your explanation?
No,
you
know, but I'm willing to be...
No, you go right ahead. I want to ask you a couple questions when you finish.
Okay. Down on page 3, lines 14 and 15 and 16, Mr. Fidanke has raised several concerns there dealing with the requirement to post a bond. That again may be an undue infringement on the right of assembly if you could not get the bond. We thought we took care of that by allowing the governing body to waive any or all or part of the bond, but Dave informs me that too is overly discriminatory, and that's probably unconstitutional, even though it's existing law. I don't feel strongly about that. It seems to me when you have that type of a large gathering, you should have some bond to ensure that you can get things cleaned up and that they'll be responsible rather than gas off into the night. But I just flagged that for you. Another point moving down to the time for removal on line 19. I would tend to agree with Mr. Fidanke that 1 week may be too short of a time, and I would suggest that you change 1 to 3 on line 19 of page 3. That would allow for more time for an organization to clean up after themselves. But the intent, indeed, under this statute, is that these structures are temporary, and they're not intended to be there and linger on so that you can go from one festival to another in temporary structures that are essentially permanent. You have to have a cutoff date that requires these structures to be taken down if indeed you are dealing with only temporary structures. And again, this whole process is to drive clearly to the point where if you have a very large gathering, that you then have to comply with our land use laws on the use of that land, because the land use laws are designed to interface the community with private needs. And if at some point in time, when a gathering becomes large enough and long enough, you are going to be interfering with your neighbors within the community, and it seems only reasonable that then you go through that land use process that we have established to mitigate those differences. That's where line section 7 comes in. If you go beyond 120 hours with more than 2,000 people in attendance, in order to continue that large of a gathering for that period of time, you must then have the approval of the local planning body for the use of that land for a mass gathering. And that's basically the major difference that this bill proposes. I think that that's what we need to do to correct those problems where you have people holding festivals but not complying with our land use laws and creating some major concerns within the surrounding community because of the length and duration and the size of that gathering and the effects it has on the local community. It seems that at some point in time, you have to mitigate the right of free assembly with the needs of the community for security and protection. And that's what we're proposing in this bill.
Wayne, I want to ask a couple questions. One is, Senator Monroe just asked me about this. You know, in the first page where you're talking about more than 24 hours, but less than 120 hours. You know?
Yeah.
Now, so an outdoor mass gathering would be defined as something that's more than 24 hours but less than 120 hours. So what about something that's more than 120 hours?
If it's more than 120 hours and if it has two conditions and if there are more than 2,000 people in attendance, then you have to have approval of the local planning body. If it's more than 120 hours but less than 2,000 people in attendance, then you would still be able to hold that under this first permitting process.
So, well, let me make sure I understand this.
It's a double qualifier.
Okay, but there's all these provisions about you have to deal with all these, you know, sanitation and all that. Now,
yeah.
What does that apply to?
That applies to both the short-term festival and the long-term festival. The only difference is if you go longer than 5 days with more than 2,000 people in attendance, you then must comply, the use of that land must be approved by the local planning body. That's the only difference. Both durational gatherings would be subject to the health and safety provisions that are listed in Section 4 of the bill.
Okay. Now, I'd like to explore with you for a moment the land use provision here.
That's in Section 7.
The local governing body in each county can decide within which zones to allow outdoor mass gatherings of longer than 120 hours.
Yes.
And the bill provides no standards, but I mean, they just decide what they think is appropriate.
Well, remember now, land use planning is designed to be as much implemented as much as possible at the local level.
Well,
the concern here is that you can't outright, you know, you can't say there's no zone. You have to allow for that possibility. But we felt, and checking with council felt comfortable that you could designate zones within an area, within the county, in which those type of long-term gatherings, not the short ones, but the longer ones, would be compatible and where you could apply. Now,
okay.
Again,
well, let's talk about we have 33 letters from Rajneesh here. I haven't read them all, but let's talk about that for a minute. The situation there is that they're basically zoned
EFU.
They're basically zoned EFU.
Now, yeah, but remember, they are contesting that. We're waiting for a Supreme Court decision as to whether or not that is a city or whether or not they have violated the land use laws.
Yeah.
That's the state Supreme Court decision.
Right.
In federal district court, there's a question brought by the Attorney General as to the constitutionality of the city because of the conflict of church and state.
Right.
If either one of those suits against the Rajneeshs are successful, that land will revert to EFU. Well, it is EFU now as far as the standard, as far as we're concerned. But if the Rajneeshs are successful, and that is indeed established as an incorporated city, then this bill will not apply to them because within an incorporated city you have your own planning process and they could designate the land as they will for whatever they want.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Day, I know
you're
finished,
sir. Go ahead and pursue.
That's fine. You go ahead and then I may ask someone.
Let's turn to gatherings in general because I want to know how this affects gatherings in general.
Yeah, I think that's an important point.
I am not willing to suspend the Bill of Rights or the Constitution because we're aggravated by a particular entity, but I am willing to regulate and to develop something that makes sense. And let's take the example of the demonstration in Portland now, and let's put that in a you have a local governing body there who is home rule and is handling that accordingly, okay? But let's put that same type of factor in your county somewhere that they want to go out in a rural area. How would it be handled?
Are they going to be there longer than 5 days?
They're going to be there longer than 5 days and less than 120 or whatever it is. Okay.
They're going to be longer than 5 days. They're going to be more than 2,000 people?
Yeah.
Then they would have to apply for a planning permit for conditional use of the land.
Okay. If they're under 5 days and under 120 hours, between 24 and 120 hours, then what do they have to do?
Then they would have to apply for a permit for a mass gathering, essentially the same that's been in the statute since 1973, with additional requirements that are spelled out here that essentially have been used by Wasco County for the last 3 years in their permitting process. And these, the conditions under Section 4 essentially are what you would expect a reasonable governing body to ask, just for the surety that their safety and health standards are met.
Well, can I ask some of those questions?
Let me,
I'd like to ask you, let's go to page 2. Now, the name and address of the applicant, obviously that's okay. And where they're going to gather, you know, what kind of an estimate they're going to have. Then the nature and purpose of the proposed gathering. I want to ask you the nature and purpose. I guess at what point, what are you going to ask about? What if I say, look, we just want to get together and hold hands? Do you have a right to refuse that if you don't comply?
No. No, all you have to do is you can put down what, in order for any governing body to understand what they have to prepare for, you need to know essentially what's going to be happening there. And you cannot prevent, this is, you cannot prevent this mass gathering from taking place based on what is written in response to that query, Senator Day.
Okay.
But if you refuse to say what the purpose is, then that would be grounds for the governing body to not issue the permit, because you would not have sufficiently filled out the information. Now, I think the question that you're raising, you see, do you understand the distinction?
I understand your explanation.
Okay.
I'm not sure I agree, but I understand.
No, that's fine. But the question is, I think the question you may be getting to is that something that you should require? And I think because of the right of, you know, privacy and whatever, that again is a judgment call. And I think you have to weigh that right of privacy versus the public need to know what is happening in a given community so that you can provide for the health and safety of that gathering and the surrounding community. It's that trade-off.
I wonder if I owned a barn out in Wasco County, had a big barn and accommodated, say I could get 2,000 people in there. Could I do that?
It's an indoor facility.
Could I do that under this bill? Would I be required to answer any of those questions?
Are you going to keep those 2,000 people entirely within that barn for the entire length of the...
Well, they've got to be in the barn, yeah. I mean, they're all going to drive out there and ride in the barn. I'm talking about a covered...
I'm just thinking about 2,000 people stuck in the barn.
Well, it's a big barn.
The kind of barns I grew up in, let me tell you, kids,
when you used to have to store hay inside during the winter, I've seen barns that would cover 5 blocks, but that's okay.
Yeah. We have one barn that would qualify, excluding the large supposed greenhouse at Rosney's Purim. We have one large barn that might hold 2,000 people in Wasco County. But I think what you're describing is this: if you kept them all within your barn, and they weren't on any of the open spaces around, they'd be exempt. But if you use the open spaces and you temporarily set you have to go back to the description on the first page on line 10, which says is held primarily in open spaces and not in any permanent structure. If you have a permanent structure, that connotates that you then have land use approval for that structure being there. And how you use structures that are approved, you know, within that state, if you want to invite 2,000 friends out for a party, and you're going to have it in your barn that has a permanent status on that facility, you know, this statute is not going to stop you. But if you want to put up a tent city on your 40-acre farm, use the barn as a gathering place and meeting rooms, but they're going to be sleeping in the tents and maybe have a open-air cafeteria or something, then you would fall under the existing mass gathering statute.
Okay. In some of the experiences of the county governing body, did they run into problems, particularly in inspection of safety and food and toilet adequate facilities? Was there problems in denial of entry to inspect for safe systems? Was that occurring or
yes, there were problems on access to find out if that was happening, but on the other hand, all of those conditions were met amply by the Raj Nish in those particular festivals. The problems that we have, and that this bill essentially, that the problem that developed in the law as far as we're concerned in Wasco County, was the inability to control the use of what has essentially become a permanent festival site on EFU land, okay, and without going through the planning process.
Okay.
And that's what this bill is designed to correct. It's that simple.
Okay, and if indeed the court challenges are upheld, then this is all the more needed. If indeed you are successful, or not you, but the court challenges on determining that it's not a city and it's in EFU, then yeah, all the more reason for this legislation.
Yes, sir.
If it's held that it is an incorporated city, then this is a moot point as far as that
point,
particular area is concerned.
Yeah. But it will establish standards statewide where a community will have some say in having to deal with a very large long-term mass gatherings. Mm-hmm. And I think it makes sense to do it on statewide policy because we've seen the particular problems that resulting from a county's inability to interface community desires and security with a private party's large long-term action.
What was the debate on the House floor? Was there a debate on the House floor concerning this?
Not a great deal.
What seemed to be the opposition? I noticed a number of people voted against. There were a number of people absent, but I looked at the voting record, and I noticed there were 10 or 11 people who normally I find an interesting I always like to look at voting and to find the dichotomy.
Here's the problem.
What is it?
Okay.
Let's get it out and open all our cards up.
Here's the problem. Now, you have a particular group that have used the law to a maximum extent. The laws of this land are designed as interfaces between private individuals and community needs or between conflicting private individuals. They're meant to be flexible and they're meant to change over time. What we've essentially found is a problem that has been created because of the aggressive pursuit of individual rights by a particular group, i.e. the Raj Nish. What we're suggesting is a response to that that will correct what has been pointed out as a deficiency in the law of Oregon, particularly pertaining to our land use statutes. Some people have accused those of us who are concerned with correcting that of being bigots or picking on the Raj Nish doesn't have a thing to do with it. You know, what am I to do if a group comes in and point out a flaw in the law that results in additional insecurity to a community that should not be there? Am I to overlook that because it was only a single entity or individual that made that discrepancy evident? Or am I, as a legislator, responsible for the entire community to try to take action on that? I chose the latter, because I think that's the responsible course to take. Some people who are not close to the issue still feel that I'm picking on a particular group. I'm not picking on a particular group. I'm trying to correct the inadequacies that they pointed out in existing law. And that's really what it comes down to.
Senator Monroe.
I can see where this legislation might be particularly useful in rock concerts. Rock concerts are sometimes last 2 or 3 days, usually more than 2,000 people. They're usually in some kind of a rural area. Sanitation is often a problem and so on and so forth. And so the permit process you have in this might very well be used in that kind of an instance, don't you agree?
Yes, and I think if you go through, especially on Section 4, you'll see them. The things that are detailed there, drinking water, sewage system, refuse storage and disposal, food supplies, toilet facilities. When you have a large group of people in a confined area, especially in a rural area where the road access is very limited, and once you get there, you are not capable of moving freely, you have to have those facilities or you're setting yourself up for extreme problems.
Also,
this statute is designed to take care of all those kind of problems.
Also, it appears to me that your requirement that they state the nature or purpose of the proposed gathering would, you know, the rock concert scenario is certainly a good justification for that, because, you know, the county and the location and all those things might make quite a bit of difference if you're having a rock concert than if you're having a prayer meeting or camp meeting or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you have a rock concert, you're going to want additional security. If you're going to have a large revival, or if the Seventh-day Adventists decide that their permanent camp is too crowded and they want to camp on a farm, you're certainly not going to need any security to take care of the Seventh-day Adventists.
Right.
So it seems to me important that you have to have that additional information. And I might add, too, that I've checked with the religious groups in the state who have large summer camps. Those are all in permanent approved facilities. The Seventh-day Adventist camp is a classic example. They've been there since the early 1900s. And all their most of their structures are permanent, and it is an approved campsite. So you're not jeopardizing any of the permanent facilities that are used.
Been called. Someone.
See ya. Have a good one.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Day.
You know, I spent a lot of time in the Hood River Wasco County area. I think that the pressures and the problems that have gone on are really tough. It's really tough, and it's tough on people living. I think going through, just as an ancillary, this whole voter registration problem that went up there and the local residents and what happened and the pushing and the pulling has just been incredible. And I want you not to think I was hostile because I, on this legislation, I'm not. I want to know basically what the cornerstones are and the parameters of how we're going to handle it. And people can yell all sorts of things, but in any civilized society, you have to have some method of coping with what you want to do. We've argued land use laws for years. The fact that, you know, it's one thing that you can do with your property what you want to, it's quite another if you influence and hurt your neighbors. And that's what this bill, I think, you're trying to bring about.
You so said it more succinctly than I did. That's basically
how you affect others and how you can deal with it. And we've had a similar situation. It was a rock concert, and they were going to do it on the Willamette River, and there was a jurisdictional problem between two counties, and we had a problem. And I am not going to confuse that with this, but I think we figured out how to do it. Both counties got together, but it was a problem. One had the permitting authority, the other one was going to have to live with the gathering. So, you know, I don't think it's a Mad Hatter here, and I just wanted to know what the cornerstones were, if you felt the weaknesses were. But I noticed all this mail, but what I'm really curious about is that...